down shortly here. In H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 6th of July, in the glorious future year of 2024. Let's see. So I haven't been to the post box in a few days, so if anyone's sent me mail quite recently, I'll not have picked it up yet. But I do want to acknowledge a piece of mail and a great kindness and some serious assistance on the part of one of our fellow Anon Radio DJs, Stug, whose show Flux is on Anon Radio at 20 UTC Thursdays, immediately after the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which of course is the show that follows this show on Saturdays because it's on every single day of the year. But Stug, so I think I related to you the adventure of the PAL VHS tape, which I purchased on British eBay because it is a tape related to the Sellafield Sightseer, the extremely strange program in which British Nuclear Fuels Limited took steam-powered excursion trains pulled by the famous Flying Scotsman Preserve steam locomotive to the Sellafield Works, the nuclear power plant and fuel reprocessing site, Calder Hall Power Plant, Windscale Reprocessing Plant, on the west coast of England, in what's known as West Cumbria, a part of the Lake District, which, according to a promotional brochure from a tourist railroad in the area, the Ravenglass and Eskdale Narrow Gauge Steam Railroad, is little known because high fells separate it from the rest of the lake country, and therefore nobody actually ever goes there, except for rail enthusiasts. Anyway, there was this wonderful VHS tape. There can't be very many copies. I succeeded in buying one on British eBay. It went into the gaping maw of the eBay Global shipping program and never came out again. Tracking information showed it arriving at LAX on May 29th. What happened after that, I don't know. eBay doesn't know. I put in a request to their customer service and they said, and they shrug, package is lost, here's a refund. You can get the same thing any day of the week here on eBay. We've got everything. No. I don't think more than one copy of that tape comes up in a year. Anyhow, being ultimately frustrated with this, and with the ludicrously high shipping charges for small items from the eBay Global Shipping Program, I asked Stug if he would be willing to receive some, not even parcels really, but just small paper-type ephemera for me, and then bundle them up and mail them onward to me, and he was very kind and did that, with the result that I have now scanned several quite interesting brochures, and I will link to those scans in this week's Step Farther Out post on anonradio.net. If you go to anonradio.net, it's a WordPress page, and a typical sidebar on the right-hand side, there's recent posts, and you will typically say one that says ASFO and then a date. I do one of those for every week, and so you can look and see what I think is interesting or important this week. Generally contains a brief summary of whatever I'm talking about on the show, if indeed I'm capable of summarizing that at all. So thank you very much, Stug, for your extremely kind and helpful assistance. Stug has also done me a great service in another way, although I think he doesn't know it yet, or if he's listening now, he'll find out now, in that he has assisted me to work out the conceptual design of the small nuclear power plant that I want to see built. Nuclear power plant for ships, nuclear power plant for remote locations. The initial unit being a prototype of about 20 megawatts shaft power, a little over 20,000 horsepower, with the ultimate idea being an 80 megawatt or roughly 100,000 horsepower unit, comparable in power output to the large marine diesels. And so you just would drop one into a container ship as a replacement for the existing diesel power plant, effectively. Or that's also what they're competing against on as shoreside power plants, is large diesel engines. And those big diesels cost somewhere in the realm of $30 million for a 80 megawatt unit, 100,000 horsepower unit. And so I'm thinking that if the nuclear unit can be priced in at anything up to about five times that, that in many applications it will be economical once you figure in the price of fuel. So yeah, $150 million would be my target for that. And so you're asking, well, how would you achieve that, and how does Stug, of all people, come into it? Well, you see, I had looked at a precedent, which is known as the HTRE-1, and it was developed into something called the General Electric 630A Maritime Steam Generator. The HTRE-1 was a test bed for nuclear-powered jet engines back in the 1950s and early 1960s, when the United States was actively working on developing a nuclear-powered jet aircraft. Now, this program was ultimately abandoned, but only after the engine was made to work on the ground, never actually fitted into a flying aircraft. But they proved they could build a flight-capable engine with a 1,000-hour fuel life, that is to say, 1,000 hours between when you'd have to replace the fuel elements, because, of course, this is what's called a direct cycle engine, meaning that the air flows into the compressor, then through the reactor, then out through the turbine, and produces thrust. And, of course, atmospheric air at temperatures of about 800 degrees centigrade would degrade the metallic fuel elements, and you can't have the fuel sloughing off, fuel into the airstream, right? You don't want that at all. Well, the program was canceled for a number of reasons, one of which being that the gamma ray signature of the thing would be strong enough you wouldn't need radar to track it. Another being the power-to-weight ratio was not great, so that it would be a very slow and unmaneuverable aircraft, probably comparable to a stock B-36. And then the third thing being that the ground handling facilities were ludicrously costly. They built one hangar out in the middle of Idaho, and it looks rather like a submarine pen. Because of the use of what's called shadow shielding, the nose of the aircraft would be poked through a hole, essentially, in a very heavy concrete wall, and the pilots would get out, and then the engine would be lowered into a pit for maintenance purposes, and then work could proceed on the airframe. Anyway, it was just a mess in operational terms, and nobody wanted to deal with it. Well, the HTRE-1, however, which was a test bed, it ran two General Electric jet engines on the ground, but it was not intended as an aircraft reactor. It was intended as a very flexible test reactor, used light water moderator and pressure tubes. In other words, there was a big tank of water with tubes inserted in it, and then the fuel elements were inside these tubes. The water slowed down the neutrons to make the reaction go, and the air flowed through these tubes. Now, when the Nuclear Aircraft Propulsion Project was finally shut down, General Electric took this design, not the jet engine design, although they worked with the fuel design from the jet engine, but they took the testbed reactor design and said, this would actually work for ships. They didn't try to exploit it as a gas turbine engine for ships, because at the time, gas turbine engines for ships were not a well-established technology. Nobody had experience with them. They figured, we can't sell somebody something they're not sure if they want to buy. So they turned it into a steam generator, right, with the gas, initially nitrogen or air, later helium, flowing over the fuel elements and then over a steam generator. In other words, basically a long coil of tubing with water flowing through it. Anyway, so I was looking at the documentation on the 630A Maritime Steam Generator, and I said, there is no reason why we can't use this as a gas turbine ship propulsion plant. Rod Adams, years ago, suggested, and I think he was quite right, that if you want to do a closed-cycle nuclear gas turbine, at least on a small scale, you need to do it with nitrogen. People have been trying for years to use helium, and there was some excellent small-scale work with a radioisotope heated system known as the Brayton Isotope Power Source, which was later converted to use solar heat. That was a NASA thing. They used a mixture of helium and xenon to get desirable working properties for the gas. But for practical power plants, you just want to use nitrogen. And because it has essentially the same properties as air, and you can use standard air turbine components. Jet engines, turboshaft engines, that kind of thing, they all use turbine blade designs and so on, which are based around the physical properties, the viscosity and density and so on of air. Ratio of specific heats, all that kind of thing, right? And so you can use the same design data, design approaches, and components for a closed-cycle nitrogen turbine as you would use for an open-cycle air turbine. Now, what has all this got to do with Stug? Well, I'll get to that in a minute. So, my idea was to have a closed-cycle turbine. In other words, it takes in heat, heats the gas flows through the turbine, then through a heat exchanger it loses heat, then through a compressor, then back through the heat source again in a closed loop. Because at this point nobody really wants us doing that with atmospheric air in an open cycle, even if it would probably be very safe. So the second design departure from the 630A that I would make is to use what's called TRISO fuel. You know, the 630A and its predecessor used highly enriched uranium in the form of finely spheroidized powder, which was incorporated into sheets of nichrome, nickel-chromium alloy, which is a very high-temperature-resistant metal alloy. It's frequently used, for example, for the heating element in a toaster. Now, for gas-cooled reactors in the 1960s, and people have proposed using it for other types. There's some folks working on using it for molten salt-cooled reactors. But there was a type of fuel proposed known as TRISO, which stands for triply coated... suffice to say that you have a kernel, which is less than a millimeter in diameter, of uranium oxide or uranium carbide or thorium oxide or thorium carbide or plutonium carbide or some mixture of those. Plutonium oxide. You can't use plutonium carbide. Something bad happens if you do. But it's coated first with a layer of porous carbon and then with a layer of silicon carbide and then with a layer of very dense carbon. And so this makes a millimeter-sized granule, just barely visible to the naked eye, which is then a large quantity of these granules are blended up with some tarry substance, which is then baked to form a graphite-like block, which contains the nuclear fuel. And this can be extruded and various other things, so you get an extended surface area for better heat transfer. Anyway, so this TRISO fuel is extremely resistant to all kinds of phenomena. In particular, there are no realistic circumstances where the fission products can escape because they have this containment. That even in the effect of a prolonged overexposure, over temperature and so on, which has been done in the laboratory for testing purposes. Right, they've had reactor loops where they have run these elements up to much higher than their designed operating temperature and left them there for weeks. What happens is, yes, the fission products, eventually the triple coating can break down and the fission products can begin to migrate outward, but they only get into the graphite, which retains them pretty efficiently too. So there's really no danger of fission products leaking to the environment. Anyway, but it's a great fuel for high-temperature operation, that the graphite is stable up to well over 2,500 degrees centigrade, much higher than the nichrome alloy used in the General Electric nuclear jet engine. And so the TRISO fuel can very easily be used to attain coolant exit temperatures of, say, 800 degrees C, which was something they hoped for with the nuclear jet engine but had great difficulty obtaining. Of course, the other half of that is with nitrogen and no oxygen. You don't have to worry about the fuel elements literally burning up. Okay, so again, what does all this have to do with Stug? I keep saying that this has something to do with Stug. So the idea being, I said, we have two stages of compression with an intercooler, and then we make use of an otherwise annoying property of small reactors, which is that the heat production rate, the power production rate, in the center of the reactor is much higher than at the fringes, or considerably higher anyway. It can be twice as high. In larger reactors, this is less of a problem. By what we do is we send the compressed gas through the central channels first at a high pressure, then expand it through a turbine partially, and then there's outer channels, which have produced heat at a lower rate. We send the gas back through them at a lower pressure, warm it up to the initial temperature again, the top temperature again, and then expand that through a second turbine. And so one of these turbines can run the compressor, and the other turbine can run the actual engine, right? The generator or the screw of the ship or what have you. It's known as a free power turbine. That's very typical for turboshaft type engine applications. Helicopter engines, the engine of the M1 tank and all those things. There's two spools. One has the compressor and a turbine that drives the compressor, and the second one has the turbine that actually develops power. But here's where it gets interesting. Essentially all proposals for nuclear heated or otherwise closed cycle, because there are other closed cycles that are used, for example, with low-pressure gas to recover industrial waste heat. But virtually every other concept for a closed cycle gas turbine, and particularly nuclear gas turbines, incorporates a thing called a recuperator, which is a gas-to-gas heat exchanger. In other words, the gas from the exit of the power turbine, or the second turbine, whether or not it's the power turbine, still is quite hot, but it's not at a high enough pressure to do work. You expand basically to atmospheric pressure, but it's still very hot. And so you take the gas coming from the compressor on the other side, which is cooler, but at high pressure, and you run it through a heat exchanger, a gas-to-gas heat exchanger. It heats up that gas coming out of the compressor. Well, there are several different schemes that have been proposed for using such a system with a nuclear heated gas turbine arrangement. One of them I've seen, the power turbine, is actually after the recuperator before the reactor. Anyway, and I was discussing this, and Stug mentioned, and I don't believe this is in any way confidential information, that the Royal Navy has some ships that have gas turbine power plants with recuperators. Now, in a open cycle turbine, such as used in a ship, a recuperator, one of these ships, a recuperator is not necessary, but it's a fuel saving measure, and it helps to particularly allow the ships to cruise on gas turbine power instead of requiring an additional diesel engine for cruising power. Well, what Stug told me, and again, I don't believe this is in any way confidential information, is that those recuperators have been a mess from the very beginning, that the people in the Navy who have to work on them and the people shoreside working for various British industrial firms who have to work on them don't like them, and that their bad performance results in an overall bad performance of the ship's low availability. So I said, I don't want a recuperator, so what else do I do? I had assumed that we would not use a steam power plant because steam power plants have fallen out of favor in the maritime world, and really in any application under about 100 megawatts, maybe 200. Steam power plants have fallen out of favor because they require a lot of manpower and a lot of maintenance, essentially. That there's always a steam pipe somewhere leaking that has to be patched up, or a valve that has to be worked on, or something. It's, as I've said in the past, it's a remarkable compliment and a testament to the people at Darlington Station of Ontario Power Generation that they had one of their nuclear power reactors, one of their CANDU power plants, operate for more than 3 years, 1,106 continuous days, without stopping. Because in most cases, it's not the reactor that breaks down and gives you trouble. It's the steam side of the power plant. So they're doing amazingly good work on the steam side. Forget the nuclear side. But what Stug convinced me of, essentially, was that the recuperator is likely to be worse than using a exhaust heat boiler, similar to those used onshore in what are called combined cycle nuclear power, gas turbine power plants, where you have a gas turbine engine, which again is basically a jet engine. It produces a lot of hot gas out the tailpipe. Then you have a nest of tubes behind that that capture that heat, convert it into steam, and use that to run a steam turbine. And typically about half of the power of those installations comes from the steam turbine. So the gas turbine, you can get 25 to 30% thermal efficiency when it's running. With a steam turbine added onto the tail end of it, you can get up to 60% thermal efficiency, although 50% is more common. You know, and those are the most efficient baseload electric power plants, fuel burning type, that we have, as long as they're running baseload. Now, if they're attempting to load follow and you're bringing the turbine up and down again, then the efficiency of the steam plant drops off drastically, and you get closer to just the plain gas turbine efficiency, somewhere typically between 20 and 30%. Anyway, so what I said was, well, given two stages of compression, it would not at all be unreasonable to use the heat recovery boiler and a steam turbine to drive one of the two compressor stages. I don't think you could get enough power out of it. I've got to actually sit down and do the math off of this, obviously, which I haven't done yet because I'm a lazy bum. But instead of having a recuperator, you just have a heat recovery boiler and use the steam turbine to drive the one of the two compression stages, because you have to have two compression stages with an intercooler in between them. Anyway, but that solves a lot of problems, in my opinion. And so, yes, that has been a brief lesson in how engineering design actually works. Somebody tells you something, and you're talking about it with another friend a couple of days later, and the two of you are bouncing back and forth ideas. This actually came out of a conversation with another friend of mine who's on SDF, whom you may know as Kuma. Anyway, we were talking on the phone, bouncing ideas back and forth about this particular power plant, and that was the answer I came up with. Anyhow, so this has been a long disquisition on how engineering design works. Well, other than that, what do I have to talk about? In the 6.5 minutes remaining in this broadcast. Well, the other day, the Wall Street Journal, and I know I pick on them a lot, but they deserve every bit of it, had an article talking about how data center operators are trying to make contracts now with nuclear power generation companies because they want to have assured supplies of power at relatively low prices. And the WSJ was talking about, well, we're, you know, this has created concern that they're going to be taking, you know, this reliable, inexpensive power off the grid for everybody else. To which the answer, of course, is, well, in practice, they've been doing that all along. It's just that up till now, they've been camouflaging it, right? Because the popular thing has been to sign contracts with renewable energy providers, giving them lots of money so they can go out and demolish a forest or pave over some farmland somewhere with PV panels or wind machines, and then that goes into the grid when it feels like it, whereas the data center pulls power off of the grid in a very steady, predictable way. And so the data center operators are trading intermittent kilowatt hours, which are of less value, against guaranteed kilowatt hours, which are of more value. So in reality, they've been taking that dependable, inexpensive power off the grid all along and not replacing it. And, of course, everybody's been lauding them for doing this because they say, oh, this is a major source of investment for the renewable energy industry, and we want to build as much renewable energy as possible because it's morally good in and of itself whether or not it solves any actual problems. I paraphrase here, but that's what the arguments basically amount to. Whereas, when they say they're going to pay the nuclear operators directly, nobody says, oh, well, this is great because it means the nuclear operators are going to go out and build a bunch of more nuclear power plants, which will be good for everybody. Now, the truth is, I don't know whether they are. I would certainly like to see that be the outcome. I'm not convinced that it will be the outcome, but at the very least, these deals are now above board, as it were, that what is being paid for and what is being delivered is the same, whereas under the previous arrangement that everyone was praising to the skies, what was being paid for and what was being received were different. But yes, I certainly hope that if these booms in so-called cryptocurrency and AI have any good result, it may be stimulating the nuclear energy industry and getting people to recognize its benefits. And is there anything else? Well, of course, I was talking just now about gas turbine engines. And I'm emphasizing that I am not proposing, although the UK Department of the Environment apparently did a study on this about 10, 15 years ago. Claire Brierley, who's a science fiction fan in Croydon or somewhere, anyway, mentioned it in a fanzine. Anyway, I am not proposing bringing back the nuclear aircraft propulsion program. But there are a lot of people today who are concerned about the use of fossil fuels in aviation. And so the European Union and various other bodies are talking about implementing a sustainable aviation fuel standard. That in the EU, beginning like next year, that aviation bunkerage is going to have to include a minimum of 2% sustainable fuel. The problem being that no one can agree on what that means. That apparently the US and the EU and the UK are all talking about developing standards for sustainable aviation fuel, and none of them can agree on what counts. That pretty much everybody will say that, yeah, you can use used cooking oil, in other words, from grease traps at fast food restaurants, but the quantity of that available is actually relatively small, despite all the, fish and chip shops in the UK, despite all the McDonald's locations, despite all the Burger Kings in France where you can get the Whopper du fromage, right, and the Royale with cheese. The supply of waste cooking oil is modest, and much of it is already spoken for by other uses. The US is trying to claim that corn oil and soybean oil, otherwise primary biofuels, should be counted as sustainable. And everybody else is beginning to say, you know, after the big palm oil biodiesel adventure, which has caused extinction of species and genocide and massive fires in Indonesia, they're not really sure about that anymore. That when you look at things like the energy balance and other environmental impacts, you know, soybeans and corn and so forth, which are grown with fertilizer derived from petroleum, and they use, you know, they have agricultural runoff which pollutes the environment, and they use pesticides and all that kind of thing, is that really as sustainable as the U.S. authorities would like to think? So, as I say, my preferred solution for a lot of this is to say, let's build some large tourist-class fast ocean liners, you know, 36-knot ocean liners like the SS United States, but with global range thanks to nuclear power, because I do want to preserve international travel. There are a lot of people who don't want international travel. They treat it as a luxury, or intercontinental travel. They treat it as a luxury. International obviously means a very different thing to people in Europe. An unnecessary luxury. And I say, intercontinental travel helps to promote world peace, which is one of the most valuable things we can possibly have. World peace and understanding is necessary if we're going to solve any of our other problems, and it can't be had only with the people who travel first class and business class, who can travel in small SSTs, which are currently being developed. But I've talked about that before. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. If you'd like to support me, paypal.me/prometheuslives, patreon.com/man_and_.